Every time our nation faces a crisis, someone seems to call for a new Marshall Plan. But although the Marshall Plan is invoked often, the full extent of its importance and impact is generally not well understood. In his latest book, The Most Noble Adventure, The Marshall Plan and the Time When America Helped Save Europe, Greg Behrman sheds new light on the characters and process that made what is considered today the greatest moment in American foreign policy. The book is published by Simon & Schuster, and I'm very pleased to welcome Mr. Behrman to our show today. Hello.
Great to be with you.
What was the situation in Europe before the Marshall Plan was devised?
The war had just ended, and Europe was decimated. Beyond the physical destruction and the human carnage, Europe's economies were in a state of acute dislocation, commercially, financially. Old patterns of trade had come undone. And there was also a prevailing sense of dispiritedness because of, you know, they were coming off of this near cataclysmic fratricide. And at the same time, national communist parties were finding fuel on those poor conditions. And to the east, the Soviet Union was moving west with expansionist designs on the continent. So Europe was in a period of great vulnerability and insecurity. And the Marshall Plan was our response to those great strategic challenges.
But there was no precedent to this sort of thing. After World War I, nobody came up with an equivalent plan. In fact, if anything, it was all about, hey, I'm going to take a little piece of this, I'm going to take a little piece of that.
That's absolutely right. There had been nothing like it.
And what about U.S. foreign policy? Had we ever done anything like the Marshall Plan before?
We never had. In fact, as President Truman said, we're the first nation to actually build up, to defeat our enemy and then to build them up again.
Now, the Marshall Plan, there was a gap between the end of the war and the Marshall Plan. How much aid did Europe receive for post-World War II relief before the Marshall Plan kicked in?
They received a lot of aid. In fact, the Marshall Plan was a $13 billion program, and Europe received from the U.S. An amount perhaps even, you know, comparable to that amount. But the difference is that it was provided, you know, ad hoc and piecemeal. It didn't have the same strategic coherence as the Marshall Plan had.
Things were the money used for?
Well, some of it was for industrial purposes based on lend-lease, which was left over the big wartime aid program. Some of it was loan packages and debt forgiveness to Britain. And there was a UN program also, UNRRA, which was a great big program.
So we weren't just tossing money over there. But the Marshall Plan was something different?
The Marshall Plan was a break. It was a break in scope and ambition, in strategic coherence, in vision, in its objectives, because what you had is you had a series of foreign aid efforts, but they were really humanitarian or designed to sort of help in a little way. The Marshall Plan was designed to get Europe's economies back functioning and self-sustainable.
And was Marshall the person who really came up with the idea?
There were several people behind the idea. George Kennan is one. Will Clayton is someone who I profile in the book, who in fact I believe is the intellectual architect of the plan. He was an extraordinary guy. He had an eighth grade education, but was a self-made man and became in fact the largest cotton broker in America. Became a multimillionaire and was a critical figure during the war years on economic diplomacy. And he, more than anyone, understood Europe, understood its economies, and understood that something bigger and greater was needed in order to launch its economies forward.
And there's also Arthur Vandenberg, Richard Bissell, Paul Hoffman, W. Averill Harriman. Except for Harriman, and perhaps Vandenberg, because they named an airport after him, these guys are largely forgotten.
They are, and that was one of the exciting things about researching the book and then writing it, is that they're figures that we know a little bit, like Marshall and Harriman, but there are others like Clayton and Paul Hoffman that have been forgotten from history. And Paul Hoffman is an interesting example. He was the president of the Studebaker Corporation. He dropped out of college also and became a used car salesman. And actually was so good at it that he became a millionaire by the time he was 34.
And had a car that looked like it was coming and going all at the same time.
Yeah, he could do it all. He was a Republican, And because he was so affable and so experienced in economics, Truman appointed him to run the Marshall Program. And so it's one instance of the bipartisan spirit which framed the enterprise.
Well, how did Hoffman's notion of the free enterprise system contribute to the success of the plan?
Hoffman believed strongly in the free enterprise system, and that was a critical component of the Marshall Plan. Communism was on the rise, because capitalism was viewed in a lot of ways to have failed America and Europe during the 30s. There was a global depression, and capitalism was equated with feeding the fascist war machines. And so communism was reaping the benefits. But Hoffman felt that the best thing that we could do is he had faith in free market enterprise and as the most efficient system, but he felt that it had to be adjusted somewhat. He felt that we had to bring in Keynesian principles, and that there was a role for government to play, and that if all could benefit from the system, its long-term viability would be enhanced.
Weren't some of the communist parties in Western Europe, I guess it was France and Italy, employing tactics to destabilize the economies of the country, and I guess in hopes of bringing down the government? I would have thought that would have been the stupidest tactic possible. Did they backfire?
They were. Well, I think it's interesting to remember back then how little faith people had in capitalism and free market enterprise. Again, there was this Great Depression of the 30s, which was a defining experience for people around the world. You had capitalism feeding fascist war machines. And then after the war, economic matters just continued to degenerate. So the view amongst communist leadership was, you know, if we can opt out of these systems and prove that they fail, they will be recourse, and people will try them. So that was the idea, but of course it was a great failure, and in part because, and I think it's a critical point in understanding the Marshall Plan, because we put forward an alternative vision. We said that there's another way to go. There's a better path, a path of hope and optimism and prosperity. And that was something that Europe lacked until the Marshall Plan, and the Marshall Plan provided it.
My guest is Greg Behrman, who is the Henry Kissinger Fellow for Foreign Policy at the Aspen Institute, author of The Invisible People, How the U.S. Has Slipped Through the Global AIDS Pandemic, The Greatest Humanitarian Catastrophe of Our Time. And his latest book is The Most Noble Adventure, The Marshall Plan, and the Time When America Helped Save Europe. It's published by Free Press. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Well, perhaps we should listen to George Marshall himself announcing what he thought the plan would do.
It is logical that the United States should do whatever it is able to do to assist in the return of normal economic health in the world. Our policy is directed not against any country or doctrine, but against hunger, poverty, desperation, and chaos, so as to permit the emergence of political and social conditions in which free institutions can exist. Any government that is willing to assist in the task of recovery will find full cooperation, I am sure, on the part of the United States government. Any government which maneuvers to block the recovery of other countries cannot expect help from us.
That was George Marshall announcing the Marshall Plan on June 5th, 1947. Our thanks to Andy Lancet for providing us with that clip. Now, that was before anybody had the plan really been totally put together by that time?
No, it hadn't. That really launched it. And an interesting story about that speech, Leonard, is that Marshall actually wanted no publicity, and he didn't want anyone in America to notice. He was afraid, because there was discussion about European recovery, that if it was high profile, that other people would seize the initiative in Congress and begin to formulate their own plans. What Marshall actually hoped to do, and another critical insight to the plan and why it worked, is he wanted to extend an offer to Europe to devise their own programs, and self-help was a governing principle.
And he had to assume that there'd be a receptive side of this by the European leaders. He had Ernest Bevin in England. There was Robert Schuman, Jean Monnet, Stafford Cripps, all out there to be impressed with. Were they all receptive to it?
He did. He felt he desperately needed someone on the other end of the Atlantic to seize the initiative. And even though most American newspapers didn't pick up on it, and even though it wasn't broadcast widely at the time, Ernest Bevin, who was the British foreign secretary, was sitting up in his bed in London at 10:30 in the evening, listening to a wireless headset, and he heard the speech.
I mean, he had no inkling until that moment.
He had there was an inkling that something was brewing, and the embassy in Washington, the British embassy, had given him an inkling, but he didn't know the extent of it or how it would be proposed or when it would happen. And he's up there lying in bed listening to a wireless headset, and he said that it was a lifeline to sinking men.
It's interesting because Marshall was thought of as a dull orator.
Yes.
And perhaps he sounded better to an English politician than to an American.
It was. Well, he was such a dull orator, in fact, that that the BBC, where Bevin heard the address, the broadcaster actually said, you know, Marshall's voice is so poor that I'm actually going to read the speech over. And that's actually what Bevin heard. And he was a little drowsy because it was late in the evening, and he thought perhaps it was Marshall he was hearing.
You've chosen to write this as a character-driven history. Why that approach?
I think because this was a time when leadership mattered. This was a program that was not determined. Like you said, there had never been anything like it. But these were really an extraordinary cast of men, and their vision, their pragmatism, their sense of humility all came to bear and really helped to drive this effort forward.
Was the Marshall Plan strictly humanitarian in nature?
It wasn't. I think that's one of the big the common misperceptions. It was certainly altruistic in purpose and in effect, but it was largely strategic in design. We were primarily concerned with the rise of communism and the Soviet threat, and it was in fact the centerpiece in America's post-war grand strategy of containing the Soviet Union.
Trigger for the Cold War.
And it helped to trigger the Cold War.
But also by helping European industries to rebuild, didn't we hurt some of our own competing industries?
It did.
We were building modern steel mills and modern auto plants in Europe at a time when some of our facilities are aging.
I'm glad you mentioned it. That was one of the great concerns when Congress and the country had this grand debate. Do we pass the Marshall Plan? Does a war-weary country and American public embark on a huge program of foreign aid at a time when people wanted a peace dividend? And that was one of the big concerns, is that we were just going to promote industry in Europe, help drive competition. But in fact, what happened is, and Paul Hoffman believed this strenuously, he believed that that everyone benefits from competition. It drives productivity, it drives innovation, and we found a trading partner and an export market in a prosperous Europe.
Were we concerned at all about creating massive inflation by putting all of that money into these countries, which were in really dire economic shape?
That was a big concern in the States at the time. Inflation was a big worry because there was so much savings and so much pent-up demand in the U.S., and because we were experiencing the conversion from a wartime to peacetime economy, people were worried about shortages. It was one of the great pressures of the time. And so people asked, is giving away all this money and goods, will that create additional shortage? But in fact, America powered through, and the American economy roared through this time and boomed, and the export market found in Europe helped to drive that in a way.
My guest is Greg Behrman, Behrman. His latest book, The Most Noble Adventure, The Marshall Plan and the Time When America Helped Save Europe, is published by Free Press. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Greg Behrman, who's the Henry Kissinger Fellow for Foreign Policy at the Aspen Institute and author of The Most Noble Adventure, The Marshall Plan and the Time When America Helped Save Europe. It's published by Free Press. Has the Marshall Plan provided a model for aid distribution ever since?
I think we've run into trouble in large part in our foreign aid efforts because we haven't hewed to the lessons and the principles of the Marshall Plan. But I think that it does offer very rich insights and principles to drive us forward.
Because we didn't see it applied in Rwanda, in Kosovo, in Bosnia. Nobody seems to be talking about anything like it in Iraq once the Allies have withdrawn from it.
Yeah, I think that's right. The Marshall Plan was unique to its time and place and had a certain specific set of objectives. But again, I think that its principles and insights are really applicable to our current challenges. And I think that, you know, Iraq is an example there. We talked about the importance of letting the aid recipient take the initiative, how important that is for their confidence and to make sure that recovery or development is self-sustainable. That's something that we got right in the Marshall Plan, and it served us well. And in contrast, in Iraq, it was the imposition of American solutions. We did not enfranchise the Iraqis.
Let me see if I understand what you've been saying. The brains behind the Marshall Plan insisted from the beginning that only Europe could save Europe. And that we were not going to come in and impose some kind of plan on them. We were just going to give them the money with which to work things out for themselves.
That's right. Europe had to take the lead. And then we would underwrite the endeavor. But we were also then going to be a partner. And we were an active partner. And there were certain things that Europe proposed which didn't work for us. This certainly wasn't writing a blank check. And we helped work with them to devise innovative solutions and to address their problems. But there was always the idea that only Europe could save itself and that we were going to be partners in that enterprise.
Were people debating the kinds of things they're debating today? Nation building, post-war reconstruction, helping friend and foe?
Very much so. This had never happened before, and people were concerned that this would be, you know, the terms they used, a vast Rooseveltian giveaway. That the aid would not be well spent, that it would be pilfered, that it would create some sort of cronyism and corruption. But one of the things that we did to address that, in addition to the soundness of our approach, is we brought on the very best, the most capable Americans to run the program. And they were not ideologues. They were pragmatists. They were self-made, and they were proven in their industries and their respective fields. And that made a big difference to the program's effectiveness.
Still, I'd imagine it would be a lot harder to bring Shias and Sunnis together than it was to bring the Germans together with France and Britain.
Well, it's an interesting idea. You know, we are one of the main differences in Iraq is that we are operating because of, I think, mistakes that we made early on. We are operating in an insecure environment, and we did have total defeat or total victory in the European context. So that's a difference. But in fact, you know, when you look at the Schuman Plan, which was French-German rapprochement, these were mortal enemies. This is perhaps the most destructive interstate rivalry in world history. They'd been at war three times in the last three generations. And 5 years after a great war, France and Germany, in fact, found common cause, and they came together to pool their coal and steel and begin to form an economic union. And so I think that is one of the great examples of creative diplomacy and finding commonality to go forward. And it's that sort of thinking and that sort of energy and imagination that we desperately need to bring to bear on Iraq, on the Middle East.
Was this money given without strings attached, or did we expect to be repaid?
We did not expect to be repaid, but there were no strings attached per se. But certainly, it wasn't a blank check. We had authorization over everything. If we felt like there were programs that weren't justified or weren't sound, we wouldn't approve them. But it was always the idea that the Europeans would run it and move it forward.
Now we're talking about a United States that until World War II had very strong isolationist feelings, and even had strong isolationist feelings into World War II. So how do you sell a plan like this to the American public?
Everyone thought that America would retrench and retreat after World War II. We had sacrificed so much. And here again, I think these remarkable statesmen come into play. You know, after Pearl Harbor, people realized that, you know, the U.S., the two oceans to our side are not impassable moats, that that we could no longer live in isolation in that post-war world, and that because of our power and our reach and technology, we had to engage in the world and make difficult commitments. And so these statesmen realized how painful that would be for America and what a break it would be. And instead of just moving along or imposing their solutions, they actually went out and barnstormed, you know, America's largest cities and its smallest towns, and engaged in a vast conversation with the American public in churches and civic groups and schools all over the country, and on radio programs. And they talked to Americans about what sort of power we'd be in the post-war world, and what we wanted America to mean to the rest of the world. And it was really a great example of a democratic conversation.
But even though we were going through a major economic boom, perhaps the best in the history of the United States, with serious inflationary problems here, we had just come out of the Depression, and now we're giving Europeans $13 billion, which is $100 billion in today's dollars. That's a lot of money.
That's precisely right. It was very difficult to sell, and there was a great deal of resistance when it was first announced. In fact, most of the country opposed it. But what these statesmen were able to do by going out and talking to people and by forging bipartisan agreement to work this forward was to outline the need, to outline the cost, the potential cost, in the event that we didn't pursue the program.
And was this mostly tax dollars?
This was funded by U.S. tax dollars.
$13 billion. Well, today, of course, it doesn't. We don't feel it. Were we not feeling it then because the economy was booming?
We did feel it, and we paid a price. And in the beginning, there were certain rationing programs, so Americans were sacrificing. And certainly, you know, this was money that couldn't be used for welfare or health care or building infrastructure in the U.S. So we paid a price. And one of the great things about this period, I think, and these statesmen were clear about it, is that they were calling the American people to sacrifice. And I think that in this sort of, ever since 9/11, I think that there is this reservoir amongst, you know, the American people to want to do something great, to want to do something, you know, noble in purpose, to help recast America and its standing in the world and what we mean to the rest of the world. And that was a time when we really plugged into that, and we drew it out, and we harnessed it to great effect. And I think that we can do the same thing now.
Well, it probably was made us a lot of friends in Europe, although there were people, I'm sure, who were afraid of American hegemony. There's a new film out called Anti-Americanism, and there's a lot of knee-jerk anti-Americanism all throughout Europe and in the countries that we helped with the Marshall Plan. Have we spent all of our goodwill by now? I some people talk about all the goodwill we had after 9/11
right,
being spent, but many Americans were resentful. They said, gee, we bailed them out after World War II, and now look at the way they're bad-mouthing us today.
Revisiting this time is instructive in that respect, I think, because there was a good deal of anti-Americanism then. Again, communism was on the rise. People were skeptical about capitalism and what it meant. People were skeptical about what sort of power America would be in the world now that it was so powerful after World War II and Europe was weak. But what they found is that the soundness of our approach and the effectiveness of our policy was having a hugely positive impact in Europe, and that it connected to people's needs and people's aspirations. And in that respect, our best propaganda back then were our policies. And I think that if we were to do something similarly bold, say, for a program of economic opportunity in the Middle East, which I think is a good idea, there's no doubt that it would be greeted with some skepticism and anti-Americanism. But if we pursued it as effectively as it could be, I think in time it would recast our country's image in that region.
So you think that the Taliban would be seen as the equivalent of the resistant Communist Party of France?
The critical thing back then is that radicalism was on the rise, and there was a utopian vision that communists offered, and people were struggling. And the Marshall Plan offered people an alternative path. It offered them something better, hope, a vision of prosperity and opportunity, to build the sort of world which they would wish to live in and bring children in. And I think that is what we do not have. It's not on offer to the region's moderates and even radicals. And I think that if we made that sort of gesture, we would embolden and stir moderates and reformists in the region, and we'd ameliorate some of the conditions upon which radicalism is feeding. And I think we'd put a lot of pressure on groups like the Taliban and hardliners in Iran and Syria that are more destructive than they are positive.
Any rumors of Condoleezza Rice putting together a group to come up with the Rice Plan?
Well, not that I've heard of, but I'm watching. I'm looking out for it. I'm hoping. But I think you are seeing some sense that there is greater room and need for non-military policy and instruments in that region. Tony Blair is going to build up institutions and the economy in the West Bank. We've just put forward a big aid package to Pakistan. There's a sense that non-military solutions, creative diplomacy, economic aid has a greater role to play, and I think we can take it to a whole nother level.
A listener writes, did the Marshall Plan have some justification in keeping a market for American goods?
Yes, I think this was a time where our strategic interests and the humanitarian imperative converged.
But we were an exporting nation in those
days. Production was booming, and we needed export markets. And we were clear about that in our statements to our European friends. And I think that it's right for a mature power to pursue its interests. The key is in how we define those interests and the pursuit of those interests, to do them in a way that coheres with our ideals and the moral imperative as well.
Well, you're suggesting there was more idealism then, but we are also talking about a time when McCarthyism is lurking, if not already starting to rear its head. This is a very troubled America as well, isn't it?
It was, very much. You find some very difficult political currents. We have to remember that the Democrats had held the White House for 16 years, and Truman was expected to lose to Dewey, and when he didn't, it frightened Republicans to the point where they were willing to pursue some unproductive means.
So the Marshall Plan was proposed while Truman was in the first term, when he had inherited the presidency, but not implemented until after he won. Do we have any idea what would have happened if Dewey had won, whether he would have gone along with the Marshall Plan?
We do. It was passed. The Marshall speech was in June of 1947, and then it passed through Congress in April of 1948. So it had been fully launched several months before the election and the inauguration. Dewey did actually come out during the campaign, and he said, "I'm for the Marshall Plan. It will continue." But there's certainly no way of knowing what would have happened with a Republican president and a Republican Congress, and certain pressures which came about geopolitically.
What role did the American media play in all of this? I guess the media at this time, we're talking mostly about newspapers and magazines.
Right. It differed. On the whole, the statesmen were very savvy and effective about using media and bringing them in and franchising them and including them. And so the media was pro, which rankled a lot of the plan's opponents. And some Republican hardliners who blasted charges of propaganda, but there were also pockets of resistance in the media, particularly in the Midwest, which was hugely isolationist,
and which remained isolationist at
which
time?
Which was isolationist throughout this period. And the Chicago Tribune, when the Marshall Plan passed, they called it Marshall's slush fund. Henry Wallace, on the political side, was deeply opposed because he felt like it would increase the tension between the U.S. and the Soviet Union.
Which it did,
and he called it the Marshall Plan, spelled M-A-R-T-I-A-L. So there's all this colorful debate and exchange because really this was something so new.
Although I imagine that the Midwest changed its tune pretty fast when it discovered that it could sell an awful lot of grain to Europe and get American dollars back.
That was one of the big virtues for American manufacturers and farmers that in fact we could benefit economically from this too.
Now, it was envisioned as a 4-year program. How long did it really last?
It lasted a little less actually. It was ended prematurely in December 31st, 1951. And really, it began to meet its end with the rise of McCarthyism and Republicans digging in, and the onset also of the Korean War, which changed our focus to the Asian theater. So it did end a bit before it was planned, but in fact, it had achieved essentially all of its main objectives by the time it did end, and probably exceeded a lot of those, which were very ambitious as well.
A listener writes, I've heard that Germany has an account held to pay back its Marshall Plan money if they're ever asked to pay it back.
That's true, actually. I don't think we're going to ask for it back. I hope we're not. But there is an account because some of the funds provided to Germany were in the form of loans. And so, in fact, it is possible for a German business or a German farmer to take out a loan that from capital, which was first provided in the Marshall Plan.
And you say we'll never ask for it back, but there are many Americans who thought it was some kind of a loan plan and have, in fact, asked, where is the money?
Well, sir, I think that, you know, some of this was provided in the form of very low interest-bearing loans, but the majority of it was straight out foreign aid. And I think that there was a general, some people may have had that sense, but generally it was understood that this was going to be an offer of aid to help rebuild Europe, and it would serve us well in the process.
How smoothly was it carried out? Was everybody on board in the White House?
It was executed very effectively in the first few years, I think in part because the country really mobilized behind it, because the strategic imperative was so important. People felt like it had to work. If Western Europe's economies collapsed, if they became communist, then we would have had the potential of Soviet expansion and domination of the Eurasian landmass. So the stakes were extremely high, and we had the foresight and the wisdom to bring on the best people to run the program, so it was credible. And there was a lot to be said for the nobility of the mission, as Marshall laid it out. People rose to the occasion. There was a sense of shared participation and engagement. And one of my favorite stories about the plan is that when they were working on the legislation to pass through Congress, people were working around the clock at the State Department, and two chauffeurs were in the men's room one morning, and the one said to the other, you look exhausted. And the other said, well, I've been up all night working on the Marshall Plan.
Greg Behrman's book, The Most Noble Adventure, The Marshall Plan and the Time When America Helped Save Europe, is published by Free Press. Thank you so much for being with us.
Great to be with you.
On tomorrow's show, the role spouses play in political campaigns. Also, how the Basilica of St. Peter in Rome was constructed. It took over 100 years and provoked the Protestant Reformation. Then a look at Shah Rukh Khan, who's one of the biggest Bollywood stars, plus the gurus of how to take your calls on everything DIY. By the way, if you've missed something on the show or just want to hear something again, you can listen to archives of past programs on WNYC.org. The Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Sarah English and Blake Neeshick. Melissa Egan is the executive producer. We had help today from Alexander Ben-Aim, Barbara Kahn, Kim Gittleson, and Scott Goldberg. Debbie Daughtry was at the audio controls, and I'm Leonard Lopate, your host. We'll see you tomorrow.